Healthcare is on the ballot this presidential election cycle, the first one since the Supreme Court ended the constitutional right to abortion. Former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris understand that abortion and other health policy issues are on voters' minds like never before.
Her speech at the DNC outlined what she felt that he might do. She said that Trump would limit access to birth control, ban medication abortion, create a national abortion, anti-abortion coordinator who would then track pregnancies and miscarriages and abortions. All of these are ideas that are outlined in Project 2025.
Joining our reporters roundtable are the journalists who cover and analyze these issues. Shannon Firth is the Washington correspondent for MedPage Today. Ben Leonard is a healthcare reporter for Politico. And Sarah Overmall is a Washington correspondent for Stat News.
Trump has talked plenty about how he wants to improve ACA and how he won't repeal it, but unless there's something much better, what is much better? Specifically, what is much better? So not just the subsidies question, but what would you do to ACA to make it much better?
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, we want to thank you all for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare. My God, the world has changed in the last 30 days. We were covering one election, now we're covering another. And, both of the conventions are over, and we're really in the final weeks of this historic presidential race. And Shannon, I'd like to start with you. One of the most striking parts of Kamala Harris's accepting speech was about Donald Trump and the additional limits she says he'll pursue on abortion. Do you think Harris successfully explained the contrast?
First of all, thanks. Thank you so much for having me, Mark. And I want to say, yes, I think she did effectively lay out the contrast between herself and a future President Trump. Her speech at the DNC outlined what she felt that he might do. She said that Trump would limit access to birth control, ban medication abortion, create a national abortion, anti-abortion coordinator who would then track pregnancies and miscarriages and abortions. All of these are ideas that are outlined in Project 2025. And while Trump has tried to distance himself from that plan, the blueprint that the Heritage Foundation laid out for the next Republican administration, so all of that may seem like a stretch, but if you look at what a prior Trump administration has done, that's the biggest indicator, experts tell me, of what a future administration would do. And during his own past administration, he chose three Supreme Court justices who reversed Roe versus Wade and ended the federal protection for abortion, which then led to what we have now, which is a dozen or more states where there's near total abortion bans. He sought to repeal the ACA, which includes requirements that employer-sponsored insurance cover birth control with no copay. And he signed a bill that allowed states to decide whether or not they wanted to defund Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood receives money from the Title X family planning grants, and that money is very important to be able to help people access birth control. So does it sound extreme? Perhaps, but I do think he's been on the track of limiting reproductive rights for the prior presidency. And the fact that he's been so back and forth on issues like medication abortion and a federal 15-week ban, he's come down to most recently say everything should be left up to the states. But it's very hard to predict what he would do when he wavers so much.
Well, Shannon, I think one of the interesting things about the convention is that the focus on the conservative policy document Project 2025 really kind of broke onto the national scene, it seems to me, pretty not so long before the convention, that this became kind of a front and center topic with, as you say, its call for a national anti-abortion movement, really. You talk about support in the Trump camp. Do you think that there's the same level of support in Congress for these ideas? And what would you identify as maybe, you know, another top two things in Project 2025 that are going to really be front and center for the rest of the campaign?
I do think that I think that Project 2025 is important to really look at that as a true concern. I know that there are members of Trump's former administration who are very heavily involved in that. I know that his running mate wrote the foreword for Kevin Roberts, the president of the Heritage Foundation's next book, which has been delayed. So we see a lot of crossover there. In terms of support in Congress for potential plans, I could see, we know that Senate Republicans have sought to block block a law that would have protected women who are traveling across state lines to seek abortion. So it's not a far stretch to think that maybe tracking those abortions and tracking those pregnancies is something that would be on their radar. I think it would be up to really the next Congress to see what the makeup of the next Congress is to decide whether something like that would happen. As far as other dangers in that plan, I mean, the plan to basically choose new civil service workers, essentially, who are aligned with Trump could have a huge impact. And there are a lot of, I mean, there are so many different challenges to reproductive rights in there. It's hard to know where to start, but renaming HHS the Office of Life or something along those lines just seems like there are a lot of dangers in that plan for reproductive health and reproductive rights.
Ben, you know, Shannon indicated that the message came across loud and clear. But after the Democratic convention, the former president said on social media that if elected, his administration would be great for women's reproductive rights. He also said he would not enforce the Comstock Act to ban mail delivery of abortion pills. What are voters supposed to make of these claims and counterclaims on the abortion issue? Talk a little bit about the Comstock Act as well, just so people don't understand what this is as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is very in line with, you know, what Trump has done on this issue. You know, he's very likely very aware of the polling and that, you know, Republicans are at a polling disadvantage with voters on abortion, reproductive rights. And he hasn't been afraid to try to distance himself from a lot of the anti-abortion groups that have supported him and controversial policies that they may be pushing, like enforcing the Comstock Act, which is it's essentially a law from the late 1800s that would be used to ban the delivery of abortion pills via the mail. It's the most common form of abortion now, so it could, you know, Democrats are saying that's essentially a national abortion ban. So he's been trying to moderate his tone on this issue, and that would probably, you know, it's upset some people in the anti-abortion movement and could potentially run against some of the beliefs of people that would be people who could be in his administration. I mean, as Shannon mentioned, Project 2025 is called for its use, which, you know, Trump has repeatedly tried to distance himself from. But I would say just overall, it's hard to say exactly what the Trump administration would do on these issues, but, you know, as Shannon was mentioning, you know, we can see what they've done in terms of regulation, HHS, FDA. They have a lot of tools there and a lot of people who might be in his administration that would, you know, want to do a lot of things on that issue.
But it's kind of interesting in his presentations, he's both saying that he's the best things in sliced bread for women's reproductive rights, but also reminding people that he appointed the three Supreme Court justices who overturned it. I'm not sure if he's not mixing his messages, or maybe he's hoping that just people are excerpting the message they want to hear.
Yeah, he just has a lot of things.
Sir, I want to pivot a bit to the issue of gun violence. And in her speech in Chicago, Kamala Harris said other freedoms are at risk, including, quote, the freedom to live safe from gun violence in our schools, our communities, and our places of worship. And of course, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy early this year declared gun violence a national public health crisis. What's the significance, political or social, of making gun violence a health issue in this campaign?
It is very significant, and we've seen this sort of growing over the past few years as more doctors, especially ER physicians, become more vocal about the impact of gun violence, the devastation that they've seen personally. And, you know, with Dr. Murthy putting out that public health emergency, he cited a lot of statistics justifying it. And I think one of the most striking ones was him saying that in 2020, children's deaths from gun violence surpassed deaths from car-related injury.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, of course, at the DNC, we saw a very long segment with people who had firsthand experienced this, lost people from it. We saw former Representative Gabby Gifford speak mm-hmm. about her experience. And reframing it as a public health issue really helps bring in this sort of human loss and the impact that the society is seeing from this. But I think also what is significant about this, and Harris putting it really at the forefront of the DNC and her campaigning, is that it's one of the things that she can really point to her own record. And it can be difficult for vice presidents to distinguish themselves from the president that they're working with. But she really does have a record here. So in the White House, she was overseeing the Office of Gun Violence Prevention. As a senator, she advocated for and co-sponsored legislation to improve background checks. As an attorney general, she joined many lawsuits or led them herself about gun violence and gun control. She also advocated for red flag laws that would, take guns from people who were deemed a risk. Mm-hmm. And even in the 2020 campaign, you know, she went even further left than Biden, saying that we should do mandatory buybacks of automatic weapons. And so this is really an area where she can say, I have a record here. You know, I'm not just the vice president of Biden. Of course, also, it is an area that's dicey when it comes to more conservative voters or independent voters who don't want to see more gun control. We've seen the Trump campaign already paint her as the most far left candidate to ever be in the Democratic nomination. So it is a tricky one for her, but I think that's another reason why we're seeing it framed as a public health issue.
Mm-hmm. And Shannon, America got to meet for the first time at the Chicago convention, Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Walz, who shared his family's personal struggle with medical debt. And the party's platform now says that the country should exclude medical debt from credit reporting agencies. What would be the effect of such medical debt changes?
So that's right. When Tim Walz was introduced to the public, he really has spoken up and keyed in on this challenge of medical debt. His own family has been affected by it. When he was 19, his father died of lung cancer, and his mother, who was then a homemaker, had to go back to work in her 60s. So it's a very personal issue for him. In terms of what he's done at the state level, we've seen as governor of Minnesota, he banned medical providers from withholding needed care from patients who have unpaid debt. He stopped the automatic transfer of medical debt to a spouse, and he stopped medical debt from impacting Minnesotans' credit scores. And why, you ask why that is impactful, why that's important, your medical debt can lead to bankruptcy. It can make it harder to buy a home. It can have all kinds of repercussions for your life. And the Harris-Walz ticket really feels that that's unfair, that something that, like an illness, could ruin your credit history, your future, is a huge injustice, really. So I think that they will be really focused on highlighting that as a priority, erasing medical debt, mm-hmm. helping states to get a handle on that.
Well, Ben, I wonder if while we're on the topic of medical debt, if you'd like to comment on where the campaign stand on both a separate but a related issue, and that's surprise medical billing, which is just what the name implies. But you've reported that putting more limits on surprise billing is a very popular issue with the public. I don't remember hearing about it during the conventions, but where do the campaigns stand on this issue?
Yeah, it's not something that, you know, is, you know, dominating Harris's nomination speech or anything like that, but it's, you know, something that they've been talking about a little bit, whether or not it sort of meets the traditional definition of surprise billing, because it's, you know, a popular issue. You know, generally, just to, you know, level set, we think about surprise billing as when bills come from that insurance patients get unintentionally from out-of-network providers that they didn't choose. and Kamala Harris has proposed in the DNC platform to expand those protections to ground ambulances. And the thinking is sort of that, you know, patients can't pick an ambulance when they call 911. They don't really have much choice in avoiding these out-of-network charges. And a number of states have done stuff on this with ground ambulances, but this would do it at the federal level. J.D. Vance and Republicans are talking about it in a different way. That's sort of not necessarily what we might think of as, you know, surprise billing. He talked about, you know, in several TV interviews, he talked about ending surprise medical bills for when patients go to the hospital to have children. And, you know, they might come up with unexpected bills. He's talking about, instead of these, you know, traditional surprise bills, more this legislation that he had proposed surrounding medical leave and, you know, healthcare premiums, so that employers can't essentially claw those back, you know, after the birth of a child, you know, if you're on leave. So, that's not likely to become law. There's no Democratic support. So it's, you know, sort of framing a bill in a way to, you know, potentially be more popular there, and not a surprise bill in the, you know, traditional sense that we might be talking about with the No Surprises Act.
And Sarah, you've written that Donald Trump has said that under Kamala Harris's administration, this is a quote, private health insurance policies are gone and she would start a communist system where everyone gets health care under a public option. What's Trump basing these comments on?
He's basing it on her record. She did, in her prior presidential campaign in 2020, endorse a Medicare for All plan. Mm-hmm. And she also co-sponsored a bill with Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont, who is a longtime proponent of Medicare for All, that would implement that plan. So there is some basis, however outdated, in truth there. She has this campaign cycle backed away from that. And actually, shout out to Politico, who had a pretty good article the other day about that, or the other week, as Mark said earlier, I can't even tell what time it is anymore. But, you know, she's backed away from that, recognizing that it is a tricky area to get into with a lot of voters. So there's some polling that suggests that while most Americans believe that the federal government is responsible for our healthcare coverage, nearly half of Americans, those same respondents, want to keep their private insurance and prefer that to the idea of a public marketplace. So she's going now more towards what Biden or Pete Buttigieg did in the 2020 election. Pete Buttigieg called it Medicare for all who want it. That's kind of the pathway that she's choosing now. What's been interesting is that people like Senator Sanders, who again has been a longtime advocate of this, are not publicly admonishing her for that backing away. And so, you know, they want to project a unity here. They kind of recognize that now, being past the primary stage, being at the stage of her versus Trump, that she does have to back away from some of these things. What is also interesting is how the Trump campaign is dealing with it. So as I mentioned earlier, they've already been painting her as the most far left candidate. So while he's saying things like this about a communist system that she wants to implement, also, people from his campaign are arguing that her backing away from Medicare for All is alienating or betraying progressives. So it's kind of a have your cake and want to eat it too situation. They're calling her far too progressive, but also saying she's betraying progressives.
There seems to be great unity on the Democrats between the left and the right coming together.
Yes, exactly. So that's the way that they're trying to maneuver this. And I do expect it's going to come up a lot more. And I think she's probably going to have to explain at some point, maybe on the debate stage coming up, what she would do if not Medicare for All.
Oh, I hope all three of you have told the campaign you're ready to do that one-on-one interview with her.
The offer is open.
In case she's listening in.
Sarah, I want to ask you about something that is not talked about as often now, which is the COVID pandemic. And while we say the COVID pandemic is over, of course, we're in the middle of a resurgence here in the Northeast right now, so it's hard to think of it as over. But you've written that its role in each campaign's rhetoric is not over, that it's still a subject of discussion. How are people using it, and what are they putting forth to strengthen their case to the American people about why they should be president?
Right. Yeah. As you said, it's not over in the sense that COVID is gone, but the emergency measures, the way that the federal government has even funded some of the response, that part of it is over. And so I was actually a little bit surprised how much it came up at the Democratic National Convention, because that's an opportunity to highlight victories, positivity, and a lot of people don't want to talk about COVID anymore. But the way that the Democrats are using it and the Republicans is not so much about healthcare on its own, but how each of these leaders handles an emergency. Uh-huh. And the ways that, you know, that impacts the economy, the way it impacts children's learning and welfare, the way it impacts people's trust in public institutions and healthcare experts, and then the lingering effects that we're having with vaccine confidence and misinformation. And so the reason that I think it's not going away is because, at least for Trump, he's arguing from the economic perspective that, you know, Democrats went too far and they hobbled our economy, hobbled our children's, you know, sociability and learning, and, you know, they fear-mongered in a way, which is some of the terminology that he and his campaign has used. The way that Democrats are using it is saying that he underplayed it and he promoted misinformation, and now we're dealing with the effects of people not trusting public health experts. Another way I think that this is not going to go away and, in fact, is going to grow as an issue is that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. recently endorsed Trump and said that he would like to have a public health role in a next Trump administration. And as we know, Robert F. Kennedy has questioned the safety of vaccines, particularly the COVID vaccines, which he called the most dangerous. And he and Trump have more recently been questioning whether the rise of chronic diseases, including autism, which we know it's been disproven that that is linked to vaccines, but they're raising that issue again, trying to link that to vaccines and saying that the amount of vaccines that children are having now is somehow correlated to chronic health issues. So we're not going to see this issue go away.
No, I think people have wanted to put it in the rearview mirror. It's not going away. We see the spike, as Margaret indicated, and as well, the vaccine is now available. So there'll be a lot of public conversation about that. Shannon, I think Americans might be surprised at this number that private companies offer Medicare Advantage plans, and they account for about 54% of the eligible Medicare population. I wonder if you could tell us about the changes a Trump or Harris administration could pursue for Medicare Advantage.
Thank you. That's a great question. I think that in terms of Medicare Advantage, yes, it is growing. And as it grows, I think there's been a lot more attention on some of the challenges and flaws in the program. I will say, as Attorney General, Kamala Harris really took on insurers, drug companies, big pharma, really sought to protect and fight for accountability among these big corporations. And I think she'd continue to try to, as president, if elected, I think she would seek to continue that that approach and really investigating what's going on behind the veil here, because Medicare Advantage has been shown to follow some practices that seem to be unethical, upcoding, using prior authorization to limit care and services, using algorithms. I know Stat had some great reporting on insurers using algorithms to prevent people from getting care through prior authorization. Basically trying to make people look sicker than they are, give them services they don't need, and rake in more money. And I think that's not something that a Walz-Harris administration would want to see continue. The GOP has traditionally been pretty supportive of Medicare Advantage, but I heard from former HHS Secretary Alex Azar that there is a modern populist part of the Republican Party that is not so enthusiastic about Medicare Advantage, sees it as corporate welfare. And while Azar himself is still very supportive and thinks that some of the reporting and some of the government analysis that look at Medicare Advantage are flawed. For example, there is a government analysis from MedPAC, the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, which has stated that Medicare Advantage costs Medicare 22% more than traditional Medicare for enrollees. There's a lot of conservatives that question that report, but it's findings like those that are driving the criticism of those plans and the need for more investigation and perhaps more regulation of those plans.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about Medicare Advantage in the coming months, so we may come back to you for further conversation on that.
Well, the presidential debate is set for September 10th. or maybe it's not. Maybe the mics will be on, maybe the mics will be off. But if the mic was on for each one of you, what would be the healthcare question you'd like to pose to the candidates? Shannon?
I would ask the candidates about the ACA's enhanced subsidies. Those are subsidies which expanded access to middle-income Americans to be able to afford health insurance on the exchanges. And those are expected to sunset at the end of 2025. I'd ask whether they plan to extend those subsidies, and if those subsidies are allowed to expire, then what would be your plan for ensuring that we don't see a surge in the uninsured rate of Americans?
Great. Sarah?
Yeah, I would add on to that one and then have another, if I may. A broader point.
You're a White House reporter, it sounds like. Get a second question.
but to put a broader point on what Shannon just said, Trump has talked plenty about how he wants to improve ACA and how he won't repeal it, but unless there's something much better, what is much better? Specifically, what is much better? So not just the subsidies question, but what would you do to ACA to make it much better? And then just another one is Medicaid. We haven't talked about Medicaid at all in either campaign. And we know from the first Trump administration that they implemented work requirements for some states. They explored block grants, which changed the funding structure and keep funding flat. And so we just have not talked about Medicaid at all.
And it was up to 90 million Americans. I know it's dropped with redetermination. Ben, what was your question?
Yeah, so I think I'd have one for each of them. For Trump, I'd ask about the drug pricing negotiations under Medicare, you know, what he thinks about that, because he hasn't been necessarily clear. And then, you know, Harris, I would ask about her previous stance on Medicare for All and what changed.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts amongst the three of you that whether or not there'll be a debate?
I'm not a betting woman when it comes to the debates. Whatever I say will be wrong. So,
I think there will be, but I don't know for sure. We'll see.
Yeah, I know they've happened most years, so tend to happen. But you know, there are some fights going on right now, so we'll see.
Well, the one thing we can probably be sure of is all of us will be watching and listening if there is. And as we look to the future, it's early to begin speculating about who could serve in a cabinet. But we did a little bit earlier when we were talking about Robert Kennedy having expressed interest in serving as Health and Human Services Secretary. And Ben or Shannon or Sarah, who are some of the other HHS contenders on each side? I assume that kind of competition is already underway. And who do you think they are and what would they mean for our healthcare system?
Looking to other conservative think tanks that aren't Heritage, since Trump is a bit on the outs with Heritage right now. So Paragon, American Enterprise Institute, America First Policy Institute. A lot of the people that staff those organizations like Heritage are former Trump officials. I would say on Roger Severino, he was the primary author on the health section of Project 2025 that, mm-hmm. you know, where Shannon mentioned earlier, there were a lot of pretty out there ideas on having an abortion coordinator, on setting up anti-abortion measures. I think recognizing now how deeply unpopular that is with voters and struggling to distance himself from that, I don't think we'll see Severino's name come up anytime soon in a real way with Trump. But, you know, maybe a year or two into an administration, we'll see him pop up.
Yeah, I think that Eric Hargan, maybe Brian Blaze. Brian Blaze has been very, very vocal about ways that he thinks the ACA needs to be reformed and concerns that he has in terms of subsidies being misused, essentially. So I think that there's definitely room for a lot of those voices in a Trump camp.
You and we are very much focused in on policy, but the question is America, there's a lot of talk about this being a vibe election, which is short on policy discussions. What's your sense is, given the short time that we have, do you think policy will find its way to the American public?
I think they'll point to it, but there's not going to be, you know, detailed, you know, plans out there just from watching the DNC. There was a lot of gesturing to policies, but not a lot of actual specifics on that. So same in the platform for both parties.
Yeah, I think one of the difficult things is, once again, just the way that Democrats are using Project 2025 and then what the truth is of those intentions that Trump actually has. We can probably consider that many things. I mean, it's a 900-page document. We can probably consider some of those things to be realistic, but then others, like a national abortion ban, just simply not feasible. And other mm-hmm. Republicans have said that as well. So some of those things are red herrings. And then on the Democratic side, you know, Harris is trotting out things that certainly are popular, like what was mentioned earlier with erasing medical debt, but without detail of how that's going to be paid for and the kind of the machinations that need to happen with state governments, with hospital industries to get that done.
I don't think voters are necessarily, unlike reporters and health policy experts, really digging into the details of all these plans. But I do think that, you know, stating clearly what their views are, where they stand on things like abortion, medical debt, gun violence, I think that's all important to the campaign. I do think there's a lot of other factors that will matter. Charisma, running mates, anything else that should come out, any quotes that should come out in the next few weeks that people have said in past years. So there's a lot that can happen in this short time.
A very short time indeed, but something we are all hyper-focused on. And I want to thank each of you for joining us. Shannon Firth with MedPage Today, Ben Leonard with Politico, and Sarah Overmall with Stat News. And thanks, of course, to our audience for being here. Be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X with our account name, CHC Radio. And as always, you can go online to chcradio.com, sign up for email updates, and also please share your thoughts and your comments about this program. Thanks to each of our guests today for being with us. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.